Welcome to MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Our guest today is the new director of the Center for Popular Music, Dr. Dale Cockrell, that became official September the 1st. He comes to us from Vanderbilt University. He was professor of musicology at the Blair School of Music there. He's the author of Demons of Disorder, Early Blackface Minstrels and Their World, as well as more than 100 other books, articles, papers, and monographs devoted to the study of American popular music. And we're going to talk a little bit today about the center's mission, what it does, and what direction Dr. Cockrell would like to see it take after we hear a few words of wisdom in this information break.
MTSU students recently unveiled the True Blue Pledge, which is a statement affirming that all members of the university family will strive to preserve a culture of kindness, respect, tolerance, and civility on and off campus. MTSU's College of Education has embarked on the Ready to Teach program, which requires that aspiring teachers not only take courses in the classroom, but serve a year-long residency in a public school, all of which will better prepare students for the real-world workplace. Dr. John Wallen, director of MTSU's doctoral program in computational science, recently was named a research fellow at Oxford University. MTSU is the fifth healthiest university in the nation, according to a survey by Newsweek magazine. Ranked first was Harvard, followed by Louisiana State University, Mississippi State University, Princeton University, and then MTSU.
And we're back on MTSU On the Record with Dr. Dale Cockrell, director of MTSU Center for Popular Music. Welcome, Dale.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
As you take over the reins here, what do you see as your mission for the center? What do you want to see it accomplish?
Well, there are so many things that need doing. One of the important things I'd like to achieve in the next few years is a fuller integration of the center into the academic and intellectual life of MTSU and of the community. The center is one of these things that's known internationally, but is often not known in Middle Tennessee, nor is it often known at MTSU. I run into students and faculty all the time, and they say, "Well, I didn't know you were over there." So clearly, we've got a mission to raise the profile of the center at the university, but also at MTSU as well. And one of the ways to achieve that is to integrate it into the curriculum more. And we're starting to reach out to faculty. We're starting to reach out to students. We're giving classes on the center. People are coming into the center to see what the resources are. We also need some development in the sense that we need to be making grant applications. We have phenomenal resources there that need to be accessioned, that need to be digitized, made available to the community at large.
I've been down in there, and you have stacks of wax and mounds of sound, as the old DJs used to say. Mm-hmm. Row after row after row of 33 and a thirds, 45s, 78s. Wax cylinders, all sorts of formats of various kinds of music. What sort of criteria do you have for donations or what you choose to accept and archive in the center?
Well, first of all, we're not just a center of recordings. We also have sheet music, we have broadsides, we have songbooks, we have manuscripts, we have business papers in addition to the recordings. So when people come wishing to give a donation, one of the first things we want to know is about the format. Is this going to be a paper donation? Is it going to be a recording donation or so forth? The first criterion is we want to talk to you about it because we're interested in it and we see it as our mission to preserve popular music materials of whatever kind. We do often, when it comes to recordings, want to point out to people that we have 180,000 recordings there already, and generally the recordings that have been preserved are the ones that are most popular, so it's likely that some of the recordings at least we're already going to have. That shouldn't put you off. We're always looking for something that we don't have, and there are many things, of course, that we don't. We don't see it as our mission at this point to edit the archives. I often say that if there's a 50% chance of it being used once in the next 50 years, then it should be in the archives. That's the nature of an archive. Who knows what's going to be useful? So if we've got a place for it, we'll likely try to take it, as long as it fits into the general pot of popular vernacular music, and that's pretty broad. We're interested in talking to you about it.
How do you maintain atmospheric conditions so that you can preserve the materials you have in your archives?
Well, it is true that it's climate and temperature controlled. Of course, we're always working with facilities services to make sure that continues. But it's a good system in there. So it will be maintained within archival standards as far as temperature and humidity control. We're in the business of making sure that whatever you bring will last 500 years. That's the archival standard, and that's the one we attempt to achieve.
And you now have collapsible shelves, I understand, because you have a limited amount of brick and mortar space.
Collapse probably isn't the right word. I hope they aren't collapsible. They're often called compact shelves, and they're on rails, and they move along, so there's always one aisle open, but the other shelves will all push together. We got those last year, and that enabled us to double our capacity. And so for the first time in about 10 years, we actually have room for expansion. And it's with that in mind that we're particularly interested in anybody who'd like to make donations.
You talked about briefly expanding use of the Center for Popular Music mm-hmm. into the curriculum and making some mm-hmm. inroads there. I think it's probably a good time or an opportunity to dispel the notion that you have to be a music or recording industry major to have need to do research at the Center for Popular Music.
Oh, I don't think that's true at all. The recording industry, of course, makes good use of it. But we have faculty and courses at MTSU in history, in English, in music, in sociology, and probably other departments that are dealing with popular music and culture. And those people come to use our collection constantly. In fact, our graduate assistants typically come from the public history program. So we serve disciplines far outside of mass comm and far outside of recording industry as well. Sure.
What is the protocol for when a student comes to the Center for Popular Music and wants to avail them himself or herself of your resources? Mm-hmm. Do you have certain standards whereby only trained personnel will be able to handle certain fragile things if they're of a certain age?
Well, the first thing when a student comes in is we have to introduce them to archival standards. We are an archive. And the backpacks go into the corner. The ballpoint pens stay in the backpacks. We have to use pencil. We have to use paper. Of course, they can bring a computer if they wish. And then we sit down with them 5 minutes and kind of go through the routine about how to handle these materials. But by and large, if these are old materials, and I'm talking about sheet music and things like that, they're still with us because they were fairly stable to start with. So we don't stretch white gloves on everybody who comes in. There are some items that we're quite careful with, and we'll probably scan them and let them use them in that case. But we're pretty open with it.
We're going to pause now for 30 seconds, but we'll be right back on MTSU on the Record.
The Concrete Industry Management Program at MTSU fills the need for trained personnel who know concrete technology and techniques. Our alumni go into the marketplace grounded in basic math and science and able to promote products or services related to the industry. Our participation in the academic common market ensures talented students in other states a chance to enroll on an in-state tuition basis. This is Dr. Heather Brown, director of the program.
To find out more information on this or other university programs, visit mtsunews.com.
And welcome back. This is Jenna Logue with MTSU on the Record and Dr. Dale Cockrell, director of the Center for Popular Music at MTSU. I believe we've talked about this before, but different people probably, based on their own personalities, experiences, family and ethnic histories, have varying concepts of what popular music really is. How does one define it for academic purposes?
Well, that's not an easy question to answer. It's a question that scholars are grappling with yet as we speak. For the purposes of the Center for Popular Music, it's pretty much everything that's not classical music. I mean, we really should have named the center the Center for Vernacular Music, but nobody knows what vernacular music is, so we went with popular music as a term that was a little more accessible. But in truth, we're interested in the music of the people, which is what vernacular music would be. And that encompasses everything from gospel songbooks to folk music to polka bands to Bob Dylan to everything else that you can imagine, Stephen Foster. But it's
Zydeco.
Zydeco, you name it, and as far back as you want to take it. We have materials that go back to the 1720s. So there's the notion of vernacular music at least that far back. And, of course, vernacular music went back even further than that, but it tends not to be in paper form or something that you can archive. So it's pretty much everything that's not classical music, but even that's problematic. You know, is opera classical music? It's music that's been loved by the people and has been sung as popular music, so even that gets problematic. And at some point it comes to the director, and the director has to go, yes or no, and I may toss and turn over that one, but I'll make a decision one way or another.
It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with commercial popularity either.
No.
Those of us who are baby boomers and younger probably think in terms of the top 40 or what's most popular on iTunes, but we're not talking about chart busters necessarily or even music that's sold in its day or at any time thereafter.
Sure. And many parts of our collection are what we call manuscript interviews or manuscript tapes that have been made with musicians who live in an oral tradition. And they are interested not at all in commerciality or in popularity or in ways to make money out of it. And that's enriched us in many, many ways. So it does encompass the top 40, but it goes way beyond what we conceive of as chartbusters, sure.
Has digital technology transformed your work in any way?
Digital technology is in the process of transforming it and has already. We're discovering that scholars, for example, are becoming less and less interested across the board in going to archives in the expectation that it's already been digitized. So we're in the business, actually, of moving more into digitization of the materials that we already have. So, yes, the digital revolution has affected, of course, not only music making in the present, but it's also started to affect our business, too. And it's one of the directions the center inevitably will have to move in the next 5 years is toward more digitization of the materials that we have. And that means getting grants, basically. So we'll be out there seeking grants to digitize and make available online yet more of our resources.
Would that be because of space considerations or just to be able to make your materials more widely available?
Well, space considerations don't have much to do with it because we digitize them and still retain the original copy. No, it's really to make it available online for scholars around the world to, for example, use our Broadside collection, which is the largest in the nation and has been digitized as a result of a National Endowment for the Humanities grant we got
perhaps
a few years ago.
Perhaps you should explain what a broadside is.
Not everybody does know what that term is. It was a popular form of musical dissemination beginning in the 17th, 18th, and through the 19th century, where a song text likely would have been printed on one side of a paper, A broadside technically just means something printed on one side of the paper, but it could be sold cheaply because you didn't have music notation on it. And it was a primary means for especially lower class people to get the text of the latest songs. They would know the tunes. They could then read the text, memorize the text, and pass it on. Folk songs like Barbara Allen, for example, were first disseminated as broadsides and remain with us yet today in hundreds, if not thousands, of versions because as it got passed on from one to another, it became topical, became of interest to the person, and changed somewhat.
No notes on it, though, so that we're not talking about sheet music, just
the
words.
We're not talking about sheet music. It's just sheet music is something that's largely been for middle-class consumption. They're more expensive. They require some knowledge of piano to play them. But these don't require knowledge of anything except the ability to sing. And that, until relatively recently, has been how most people made music.
That brings a historical question to mind. The invention of movable type, Gutenberg's movable type, mm-hmm. was thought of and is acknowledged as absolutely revolutionary mm-hmm. because up until that time, only the elites, the clergy and the nobility, could avail themselves of the printed word, even mm-hmm. if it was the Holy Bible. And Gutenberg's movable type made the printed word disseminatable to mm-hmm. Millions of people. Was there a similar revolution to go that way in the musical world that helped make music either in lyric and notation form or in any a format that you could actually play and listen to mm-hmm. more accessible to the average everyday folks and less a province of the elite and the elite only?
Absolutely. Movable type with music notation follows movable type for words by about 100 years or so. But by the 16th century, technology had been developed for printing books of music instead of, as before, having to be written out by hand. In popular music, it's not until the latter part of the 17th that the technology is common enough that middle-class people can start to afford it. And it's really not until after the Civil War that it becomes inexpensive enough that common-class people could start to afford it. So it takes some time before it works its way down. I mean, it's still a complicated process. If you've ever tried to sit down with Finale and make sense of that program and do something with it, it's still a difficult thing to do. So.
Yeah. I'll cut this part of it out. This is a good place to do another break. So we'll take another brief break, but don't go anywhere. We'll be back momentarily with more MTSU on the Record.
The MTSU Educational Talent Search, or METS, reaches out to students in grades 6 through 12 in Coffee, Grundy, and Warren counties. We provide youngsters who have college potential with educational and financial aid counseling and guide them as they determine their educational and career goals. More than 95% of Educational Talent Search students graduate from high school and more than 79% enroll in post-secondary education. This is METS Coordinator Debbie Frisbee.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
Dr. Dale Cockrell is our guest today on MTSU on the Record, and we are talking about his directorship of the Center for Popular Music here at MTSU and the many roles that it fulfills. You have a gentleman working for you named Martin Fisher, mm-hmm. With whom I'm familiar, and he likes to make Edison-style wax cylinders. It's not exactly wax. It's a different chemical composition, but in that style of modern contemporary music. What else does Martin do there at the center that is helpful in your preservation of popular music?
Martin is our curator of audio media at the center, and he's the person in charge of the lab over there, which is a state-of-the-art transcription lab. And Martin's responsible for taking any format, any recorded format, and being able to digitize from that format. So if you've got cylinders or 78s or 45s or 8-tracks or cassettes or 7-inch tapes or whatever, it's Martin's job to take those and to preserve them and to make them accessible in ways they are now. It's his interest in cylinder technology, I think, that first drew him into this work, but now he's become quite a wizard and taking anything that you want, bringing it in, and making sure that he can then turn it into something digital. He may even rely on unusual technology to make that possible. For example, if you were to bring in a 7-inch Scotch tape for Scotch-made tape from 20 or 30 years ago, he would first of all have to put it in his jerky machine for 2 or 3 days to warm it up so that it could then be played on a tape machine safely. So
somehow I doubt that Ron Popeil had that in mind when he started selling those things.
But the jerky machine is in the back of the lab. You can come test it, and it's very often on, and it's baking tapes.
Does reel-to-reel disintegrate into powder if it's not preserved properly, the way that, you know, film made out of nitrate dissolves into powder if it's not stored properly?
It's a problem, and that's one of the reasons he's baking it in the first place, is to soften it up and to get it to adhere to itself in a way that it wasn't before. I'm not the person to ask. Martin's the expert on it. I just go in and marvel at what he does. But yeah, it's always a problem, is that stuff falling apart.
You know, there's been sort of a retro renaissance in vinyl lately. Mm-hmm. There are aficionados searching stores for 33 and a thirds and all kinds of oddities, or things that would be considered oddities to the CD slash download generation. Is there any value in sometimes preserving something only in its original format for historical purposes, or is the hardware less important than what's on it?
Vinyl is much more stable as a format than CD formats. I mean, the projection for vinyl is that it'll be around and still be playable for hundreds of years, whereas archival projections for CDs are at best 50 years, and maybe even less.
You maybe have a few snap, crackle, and pops on it, but some people say they prefer to listen to it that way.
Analog is always going to be a more natural way of listening to music, because that's the way we hear. Our ears are analog. They're not digital. And you can get into the technicalities of digital, but it's necessarily chopping up, especially some higher frequencies. So sure, there's been a renaissance. In fact, we were just at the National Folk Festival running a booth, and right next to us was United Vinyl in Nashville. And I was amazed. They were talking about vinyl, and they have a manufacturing facility up there with 70, 80 employees, 52,000 square feet, and they are pressing vinyl. It's the largest vinyl pressing in the United States right now, and they don't have enough room and can't get enough people in there to start fulfilling their orders. So it's something that's happening now. It's not just an old technology. It's still going on.
Do you understand the mentality or the sentiment of some popular music listeners to listen to something in its original format, even though it may be full of snap, crackle, and pop, as certainly an old original Edison cylinder would, rather than the pristine, pure, digitized quality that today's audio purveyors claim to have?
Well, you're asking me for my opinion.
Yes.
And my opinion is, well, I don't prefer to listen to it as a cylinder. I don't prefer to listen to it as a 78 for myself. I appreciate the ambiance of that, and I appreciate being able to listen to it with the ears of days of yore.
Yeah, as a historian, you understand. You don't freak out or go, oh, gross,
No.
As a historian, you appreciate the era.
You appreciate the era, but you also appreciate the perspective of the ears of the people who are hearing it that way. The pristine sound of digital,
Well, some people think it's too antiseptic.
Well, it's, again, you can get into technicalities, but if you're sampling at 44,000 samples per second, that means that the upper end of the frequencies are necessarily no longer smooth waveforms, but they're jagged, and many people claim they can hear that, and that gives it that kind of antiseptic sound, because it's not the way human ears hear things. And I agree to that to some extent. I mean, once I hear good vinyl, it's got a lushness to it that you just can't. Or tape. I mean, of course, tape is even better. But that tends to deteriorate, and most of us don't have the ability to play that. But you're asking me for opinions, and that's my opinion on things. You know, opinion is necessarily unsubstantiated, so there's no truth in it. Pay no attention to what I say.
Well, I'm about to ask you for another opinion, so here we go again. How do you feel about the digital software that in the recording industry process enables people to clean up shall we say, faults in a singer's approach to a song. When they're off key, they can be corrected digitally. Overdubbing, of course, is nothing new, but there can be production techniques that can mask flaws in a performer's artistry.
Well, I've produced some records, and I've taken a full advantage of Pro Tools when I had the chance to do that. So, so maybe it's not fair to ask me these questions, but we've used those things. We try to use them judiciously, and there are mistakes, or they could be called mistakes. There are matters of interpretation that can accommodate the aesthetic of the producer and the engineer. And so by taking Pro Tools, you can kind of move things around, or you can steal a second from another take and interpolate it into the better one. At some level, that's making for a better performance. As long as you haven't ruined the sense of the performance, the sense of the moment of it happening. Now, as for auto-tuning, I guess I don't object to that too much. I know how difficult it is to sing in tune because I was a singer. And if they're trying to get it in tune, well, if you can help them out just a little bit, as long as they know that there is such a thing as in tune and out of tune. And again, it's done judiciously. I don't guess I have too much trouble with that, as long as it hasn't ruined the performance. But, you know, being in tune and out of tune can be expressive as well. And you'd hate to have auto-tune on making everything perfectly in tune, because then our great blues singers would not have been our great blues singers, because blues is necessarily under the pitch.
Or some of our rock singers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It can be deeply expressive.
One more quick break. We'll be right back with more MTSU On the Record right after this.
The Middle East Center at MTSU seeks to promote greater understanding of the politics, history, and culture of this vitally important region of the world. Its mission includes the promotion of outreach programs and faculty research. The center sponsors lectures by Middle East experts and scholarly exchanges. We're especially pleased to offer a new interdisciplinary minor in Middle East Studies with courses in Arabic and Hebrew. This is Dr. Alan Hibbard, Center Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
Dr. Dale Cockrell is our guest today on MTSU On the Record. You said you were a singer. I have to find out what you sing.
Well, if you're going to ask for a demonstration, you're not going to get it. But
how about just an explanation?
Well, I started out as a music major, and I was a singer. I grew up in a small Southern Baptist church in western Kentucky where to sing was to go to church. My mother was the church organist, so I grew up singing. From 7 years old, I was singing in parts because that's what everybody did. When I went to university, I went to Murray State in western Kentucky, started out that way as a voice major, because that's what I did best. Became interested in musicology on toward the end of my undergraduate career, continued to sing through that, and occasionally I'll even sing now. I'm working on a project, and it requires concerts sometimes, and I've been known to rip into The Girl I've Left Behind Me on occasion, but as I say, you're not going to hear it now, and I hope there are no recordings made of that.
Okay. Dr. Dale Cockrell, director of the MTSU Center for Popular Music, thanks for being our guest today.
Thanks, Jenna.
Okay. MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.